This is The Guardian.
Hi, everybody. It's Max here. Just to say that the sad news about Walter Smith's passing happened after we'd finished recording the pod. So we obviously send our best to his family and his friends, and we will pay tribute to him properly on Thursday's pod. Cheers. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Europod. It is an El Clasico without Messi, Ronaldo or Ramos. More of an El not quite as Clasico as Real edge out Barca. Real Sociedad lead the way despite losing a two-goal lead to Atleti. How nice to see David Silva running around being great. In Italy, goals at both ends for Zlatan as Milan beat nine-man Bologna. Their joint top with Napoli, whose 100% record is held up by Roma. Both managers sent off. Jose seemed to take it quite well, to be honest. Juve get a late penalty to draw with Inter. In Germany, Archie's here to talk about Bayern being really good, Bellingham being really good, and Stefan Baumgart's flat cap. And we've sent Barry to his boulangerie to report on all manner of crowd disturbances in France. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Sid Lowe. Hello, Sid.
Good morning, Max.
Nice to see you. You're just here for part one because you're just too busy.
I've got to go down to Vallecas, unfortunately.
Okay, what happens in Vallecas?
That's where Rayo Vallecano are playing Barcelona tomorrow.
Ah, okay. Nicky Bandini, hello.
Morning, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And hello to your dog, or Sid's dog, or I don't
it's
know.
That was mine, I'm afraid.
Sorry about that. That was Estella.
Okay, hello, Estella. Archie Rintutt, welcome.
Hello.
And Barry Glendenning, how are you?
Bonjour, Max.
Dave says, after the Barney Ronay Jonathan Wilson double pivot of cynicism, it's refreshing to see you experiment with a younger, more continental-feeling side in the midweeker. That's what you lot are. Let's start then with you, Sid, because you've got places to be. The first El Clasico without Messi or Ramos since 2004. A question which I imagine you'd contest from Mintz, which says, is the El Clasico even relevant? Now Messi and Ronaldo have both left. Seen no build-up in it and stumbled on the result on Twitter. I mean, I presume he or she could have spent more time and actually watched the game. Is there a feeling about it? I mean, I understand the question's a bit ridiculous, but is there a feeling about the status of El Clasico at the moment?
Oh, definitely. So in that sense, the question makes sense. There's definitely a feeling of this being a kind of an in-between Clasico. You've got obviously the fact that Messi and Ramos both went in the summer. Of course, let's not try and equate the two. Messi going is bigger than Ramos going, but we're still talking about two captains. The two men have played more Clasicos than anybody else. Two men, by the way, who also didn't necessarily want to go. So there's a kind of sense that they departed for reasons that weren't really the right ones as well.
Sorry, Sid, could I briefly interrupt? Ramos left Madrid? I missed that.
Are you serious, Barry? Come on. You can't even admit that. Are you for real?
I'm deadly serious.
Really questioning.
Has he not walked into your boulangerie at any point in the last?
Seriously, the you know, when you have those meetings going, you know, would it maybe we could get Lars on the Europod? He's more across things than Barry Glendenning. I mean, I admire your honesty, Barry.
Well, this is like you never knowing where Jay Rodriguez is.
Is it? Is it?
Should I just resign?
Maybe. I don't know. I love your honesty.
Let me ride to Barry's defence here.
Okay.
It's perfectly plausible that you didn't notice Sergio Ramos because Sergio Ramos has not played a game for Paris Saint-Germain yet. Didn't play for Spain in the Euros. Only played, I think, four times for Real Madrid since the turn of the year. So in this 2021, Sergio Ramos has been a non-person. So just about let Barry off.
Anyway, you were saying.
I don't know what I was saying now. I just love. I was saying that those two have gone. Obviously, Messi going, of course, is bigger. Let's not pretend otherwise. And then you add.
Hang on, Sid. Did you know Lionel Messi had gone, Barry?
I did. I was across that one.
Okay, excellent news. Carry on, Sid.
So there's this team called Real Madrid.
Couldn't we just start this podcast again?
Anyway, sorry, where was I?
We're talking about the status of El Clasico, right?
So you've got these departures. You've also got, of course, the fact that Real Madrid chased Kylian Mbappe in the summer. And we've already talked about this before. It was partly performative, but it did kind of it did bring that idea into people's minds that Mbappe will be at Real Madrid next year. Then you look at the Barcelona players that are exciting people, and they're all very, very young. So this kind of felt like an in-between Clásico. It felt like this is the bridge between a previous generation and maybe another one. And there's absolutely no doubt that within Spain, there is a recognition now that, yeah, some of the best players in the world are not necessarily at these two clubs. Although there is at the moment, of course, an enormous campaign building to try and get Karim Benzema the Ballon d'Or. So who knows, it could be in a few days whenever it is the votes are counted that we go, oh, actually, the Clásico does have the best player in the world again.
I know a Polish man who wouldn't be very happy with that.
Well, I know an Argentinian who wouldn't be very happy with it either. And it does feel, I mean, it's, look, Benzema is absolutely brilliant. There's no two ways about it. His level of performance is a bit, I can't believe we're talking about the Ballon d'Or. Stop me, right? But just talk about something else, please.
I was going to say, I'd rather die.
I really would.
You can't just say a Polish man and an Argentinian without telling the names to Barry, because he'll be, who could this possibly be?
Right, Barry, there are Lech Walesa.
And Ozzy Ardiles.
And a guy called Perron.
Nevertheless, Sid, though, there is something about a full Nou Camp. And I don't know if it's because it's... I think it's because it's got three tiers. I don't know how many amazing stadia have the extra tier that just make it look just such a sort of... It's such a beautiful thing, is what I was thinking when I was watching the highlights.
It is absolutely enormous. I mean, look, for example, at the weekend, I don't have the exact figure in front of me. I think it was 80,600 and something people in the stadium. And there was a lot of empty seats. You know, this is a stadium that holds 99,000 people. And you're right, it's very, very steep. It's going down, by the way. They're going to rebuild it. There's bits of it that are crumbling. It's in a mess. There was this brilliant story. I don't know if you saw this one, Barry. This is one that you would like if you'd seen it. There was a brilliant story after the members' assembly at Barcelona. They were talking about the financial crisis, but also talking about the state of the Camp Nou, which needs redeveloping. And they said in the VIP part of the ground, they can't have any oven cooked food, because the fuses would go, basically, in the stadium. They don't have the electrical capacity to do that.
I remember doing the breakfast show for BBC London in a double-decker bus in Walthamstow, and we went off air because someone unplugged the bus and plugged in a waffle iron. That was us.
To be fair, I'd rather have the waffle than the radio show.
Now, how was the game? I mean, Alaba's finish was beautiful. It was a lovely move, wasn't it? And he struck that ball so beautifully as well.
Yeah, it's a brilliant finish. I hate to say this, but this doesn't really help my counter-argument to the Clásico isn't very good anymore, because the game wasn't great either. You had, I thought, a Real Madrid side who largely controlled it. Barcelona had most of the ball. Barcelona had one really clear chance for Sergiño Dest, which he smashed over the bar. And if he scores that, perhaps it's a different game. But it felt like Real Madrid knew that, okay, we wait here, they come to us, we go, boom, over the top to Vinicius, and we catch them every time. And it felt really, really simple. And it felt that once Madrid had the lead and they could kind of reinforce that idea, they were never really put in trouble by Barcelona. You know, it's 2-1. So you think, oh, well, you know, that's three goals. Yeah, but it's Real Madrid make it 2-0 on 93. The game was already done, it felt like. And so that meant that when Barca scored in 97, it sort of didn't matter.
Barcelona have condemned the, quote, violent and disdainful acts faced by Ronald Koeman when he left the ground. Videos on social media showed people surrounding his car, blocking it from moving.
Have you seen it? It's a very bizarre video, because it says to me, as much as tension, because obviously you hear that, and my first thought was, wow, that's really bad. You know, the fans are against Koeman enough now that they're laying into him, that he's going to genuinely get nasty. Now, look, there is a small element of that. There is a small element of frustration at how they're playing and so on. But within the ground, he's actually not getting attacked. He's not getting whistled. He's not getting many people to have a go at him. And the degree of patience has, I think, been quite striking. When you see the video after the game, it's lots of people surrounding his car, and it's a few people shouting, you know, get out of here. A few people sort of knocking on the side of the car. But actually, fundamentally, when you see what the video is, and I'm going to sound like such an old man now, so sorry about this, but I'm going to say it anyway. It's basically lots of kids with their mobile phones trying to throw themselves in front of his car while filming it. And so, yes, there's a sort of an aggressive element to it. Absolutely there is. I'm not pretending otherwise. Yes, it's nasty. Yes, it's unpleasant. Yes, it's people shouting things. But the last bit of the footage is literally a kid throwing himself spread-eagled over the bonnet, filming himself, going, "Way, look at me here. Look at this twat behind me," sort of thing. And it's just, you just think, and, you know, forgive me for being an old man, it's a bunch of dickheads being dickheads, basically.
Well, noted. Do you...
I mean, that's this pod strap line, isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, I don't do I need to ask if Koeman's safe or not safe? I feel like we sort of have this conversation every time.
Well, that's exactly the point, so I'll give you a very quick answer. We have had this conversation lots of times, which is why you sort of don't need to ask. This game doesn't really change that, except just to reinforce what we all knew, which is he's in place because there wasn't a viable alternative.
Okay, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer might be available soon, I guess. Real Sociedad had a top. They do 2-2 with Atleti. This was a good game, wasn't it? They were two up. Their first goal, I thought, was a great... The assist was perfect. Like this ball that was just... It couldn't have been played more perfectly. The pace on it to just entice the keeper, but not, you know, not give him enough chance to get it. And I just thought it was nice to see David Silva because, much like Barry, I'd sort of forgotten where he was.
Yeah, and well, he's been injured a bit as well. So I think forgetting where he was is natural enough. They're a really good side, Real Sociedad. This year, they have a variety to them that I think they probably didn't have last year. They've had a few performances where they've been a bit more defensive. This time, they changed their formation to a formation I don't think I've seen them play in the entire time. I might be wrong. There might be an occasion in the entire time with Imanol, who's the current manager. And the goal's lovely. And it's not just one pass. It's three in a row. It's ping, ping, ping. And Atletico are just sort of taken completely open. And Real Sociedad had a really good side. The significant thing I thought about this was that after the game, Imanol started talking about the number of points you need to be champions. Now, he did that to say it's very difficult to imagine us getting to this number of points. He said, you know, the champions will probably have 80 or so points and it's very hard for us to get to that. So in a way, he was saying, no, we're not going to be champions. But it's the first time I've ever heard him engage with the idea that there might be a target. And so maybe they are starting to think that it's not impossible.
Anything else you want to tell us, Sid? Or are you happy with your work?
Yeah, should I tell you about Borja Garcés? So Borja Garcés has been told by his manager at Leganés in Spain's second division that he will never play for them again because this weekend he bailed on training to go to his brother's wedding. And this has created a whole debate in Spain about which events should your contract allow you to go to and not? Which family events is it justified for them to say, no, you can't go? And if they say, no, you can't go, is it justified for you to then say, no, forget it, I'm going anyway?
That's a good question, isn't it? I mean, like, you know, it's very acceptable at my level of football. You know, I'm off on a mini break. Or, you know, I always think professional clubs don't have this problem. They go, look, I just, you know, I'm moving house or I've got to go to the tip. So I just can't make this weekend's game.
Well, this is why players invent injuries.
Hmm. Or get suspended over Christmas. But I think, you know, when he looks back at his life, not that I can remember pretty much any weddings I've been to, you want to be at those kind of occasions, don't you?
Did you know I wasn't at David Beckham's presentation as a Real Madrid player because I was at my brother's wedding. So you know, that's the closest thing I can come up with.
I really thought for a second there Sid was going to say he wasn't at David Beckham's wedding, which I would have loved.
I would like to make it very clear at this point, I was not at David Beckham's wedding either. But the bastard didn't invite me. I'm really upset about it still. It hurts. Thanks for bringing that up, Nicky.
I was at a wedding the day Sergio Ramos moved.
Sid Lowe there, disappearing off to watch a football match, which he does plenty of time. That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do Serie A. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, comfort eating with Grace Dent. It's actually a real thing. It sounds like so Alan Partridge goes, oh, I'm stuck. What am I going to do? But it's an incredibly successful podcast. It launches today, Tuesday, the 26th of October, season two, hosted by Grace Dent, the Guardian's award-winning restaurant critic specific copy that can be shared to describe, it says here, which I believe may be something like say something like. Join Grace each week. She invites a famous guest to throw the cupboard doors wide open on their favourite comfort foods, tuck into episodes with Stephen Fry, Desiree Birch, Russell Tovey and more as they talk about friendship, family and the foods that have seen them through it all. It's released every Tuesday for the next 12 weeks. First guest Stephen Fry. Barry, where is the crossover episode with you?
I haven't been invited on to comfort eating with Grace Dent.
If you were, would you go on?
Yeah, why not? I'm a big Grace Dent fan.
Oh, excellent news. And does she like you?
I say she has no idea who I am. Well, which is probably why I haven't been invited on to comfort eating with Grace Dent.
Well, maybe it won't go on her feed because she just wouldn't want it on her podcast feed, but it could go on our one as a bonus pod. Anyway, wherever you get your podcasts, please listen to it. Thank you. Nicky, Serie A, where do you want to start? Inter Juve, was that the sort of biggest game of the weekend?
Yeah, I suppose so. I'll be honest, like I'm normally number one hype woman for Serie A and I think stuff is exciting. I found this sort of big Sunday night we had when it was Roma against Napoli and then Inter Juventus. I found it a bit of a letdown. I had such high hopes for these games and neither of them quite sort of fired in the way that they could have done. Obviously, it was great having Inter Juventus, the Derby d'Italia, of course, the Derby of Italy, played in not quite a full stadium, but they had, because they still got restrictions on capacities in Italy at 75%, but 56,000 fans. It felt like a big event. It felt like something that we hadn't experienced in a while. But I think Juventus have really bought into, under Max Allegri, this idea of building from being solid at the back first, basically. And he sent out a team that left out Federico Chiesa, that left out Paulo Dybala. And then even when Federico Bernardeschi, who we started on the left wing, gets injured after 20 minutes, less than 20 minutes, and you're looking and thinking, okay, now you've got to bring on Chiesa, right? You can't just ignore one of the best players in the world who's sat there on your bench. He doesn't. He goes and sends on Rodrigo Bentancur because his whole approach to this game is don't concede a goal and at some point we'll score one. And not shockingly, you'll be shocked here, not that different from what Jose Mourinho tried to do for Roma against Napoli. And they did concede a goal. It was a bit of an unlucky one for Juventus because it was a Calhanoglu shot that got deflected and Dzeko swept it up. And then it seemed like Juventus probably were going to lose the game until they got a penalty on a VAR decision in the 89th minute, and everyone went, it's Juventus. Of course, they got a penalty on a VAR decision in the 89th minute. I think it was a penalty, but it was an inevitable controversy at the end.
It was one of those where it didn't feel right, but it probably was. Can I ask a stupid question? Why is this game the Derby d'Italia?
Basically, just to do with the long-standing sort of rivalry between the two clubs. There have been times when there have been Milan directors who've sort of tried to say, well, this is the real Derby d'Italia between us and Juventus, because really, Juventus have always been, or certainly for a very, very long time, the most successful club in Italy domestically. And Milan have always been the most successful club in Italy in European football. But just over the years, there's actually been quite a lot of sort of positive relationships between Milan and Juventus at a directorial level. People have got on with each other. People have collaborated in terms of transfers between the clubs and things like that. Whereas Inter has always had this sort of hostility towards Juventus. There's always been this sort of big brother, little brother thing. It's felt like a lot of the time going on, especially with Juventus always winning, Inter spending all the money trying to usurp them and not doing it. So it goes back to, again, a lot of it is individual stories that have built up to this narrative, although in the end, the actual Derby d'Italia name was coined by the Italian journalist Gianni Brera, who lots of things in Italian football language come back to this one man who was particularly sort of iconic in his writing.
What was his name?
Gianni Brera, who was a very famous Italian journalist who, yes, lots of the things that he wrote became part of the Italian football lexicon, and the Derby d'Italia is one of his.
The Italian Danny Baker. It sounds like Danny Baker. Did he do an own goals and gaffes video? Was he slightly more high end?
He wrote lots of, he has lots of sort of things that are sort of quite neat, like the Derby d'Italia, that is nice things you can sort into the lexicon. He has some things that frankly were a bit bonkers. Like he had this theory that the reason that Italians had to win playing Catenaccio is that Italians were fundamentally not as strong people as other races in Europe, and so they had to rely on different natural resources such as their cunning and things like this. So he had some ideas that were a bit less comfortable than others, but he was a very very influential writer and someone who even the sort of players, managers, directors all seemed to buy into what he was doing a lot of the time.
Did you see the photo that I sent this WhatsApp group of the personalised shin pads of one of the Inter players who was hugging Chiellini, I think, and had what I presume it looked like a sort of printed face of his baby on his shin pads. I couldn't help wondering, like, it's kind of a nice thing, but also, like, they get kicked a lot, don't they?
I'm pretty sure that was Niccolò Barella who was hugging Chiellini. And yes, it's a striking image, isn't it, as well? I couldn't tell, because it's only a small photo, whether or not the eyes of the baby have been enhanced as well, because it looked very sort of, like, intense. It
looks like an evil Evian baby.
I think it's his new daughter.
It does.
It does a bit. I think it's his new daughter, Barella, who's, gosh, I think he's 23, 24 years old. He's already got, that's his third child. He's not wasting any time. Yes, I did think that myself, actually. I thought, do you really want the face of your new baby getting kicked all game? But
if you have three children, which two do you put on the shin pads? And where do you put the other one?
Do you know what I was thinking, actually, was... when we were talking with Sid about skipping for your brother's wedding, I was like, well, does it depend about how many siblings you have? Because the Barella family feels like if it's at three already, it could end up at like eight or nine. And then do you get to go to all of their weddings, or do you have to pick your favourites, or I don't know.
I think you'd say, if you're a professional footballer, can you not just get married out of football season? Do you know what I mean? Like, that would be useful. In the Roma Napoli game, both managers were sent off. Was it more exciting off the pitch? I thought Jose, I couldn't see what Jose got sent off for, but he looked a bit miffed, but not as bothered as Spalletti, who looked very confused about the whole thing. They were at different moments. They weren't having a fight.
Yeah, well, Jose got sent off for a double booking, which is quite rare. Doesn't happen too often. Spalletti got sent off after the game when he says he was just going to the referee and trying to say, you know, good game to him, basically. And the referee misunderstood what he was trying to say and sent him off. There were four managers sent off this weekend in Serie A, in fact. But look, Jose, Roma Napoli was an awful game. I didn't think it was interesting at all. It was very much Roma under Jose going to the very low Mourinho block and setting up camp and essentially deciding that they wanted to just stop Victor Osimhen from scoring against them, which they did, although he still hit the post. Jose is walking a fine line already in that sort of, are we about to see him tip into the dark, Jose? Because, of course, the precursor to this game, and the reason why I think it's least surprising that Roma took this approach, is that they got walloped 6-1 by Bodo Glimt in the Europa Conference League, which is an extraordinary result, no matter which way you look at it. I mean, that's, to lose to them is one thing. To lose 6-1 is astonishing. And his reaction to this was to come out afterwards and say, well, now you understand why I never rotate my team. I've got 12 or 13 players and that's it. And he sent five of the players from that game. He didn't even include on the bench for this game. He made them all go and sit in the stands. What's extraordinary, actually, is that the team was 2-1 down at halftime in that game. Obviously, it was a heavily rotated team. And actually, he brought on three substitutions at halftime, two more after 60 minutes to bring the team quite close to his first team, and they still conceded those five more goals. So I don't know quite why it's all of the starters who got thrown under the bus, but he's absolutely sort of now gone full nuclear. Half of my squad is rubbish. He said it again after this game. I can only rely on this very small number of players. He said in the Napoli game, well, it would have been nice to bring on an extra fullback at a certain point, but I don't have any. It was really like this mode already, which when you think they spent close to 100 million euros in the transfer window, it's a pretty aggressive line to be taking at your new club already.
Nikki, a few things. Yes. Firstly, I've just noticed your dog on your sofa and it's really, yes, adorable. Particularly because he's just opened his eyes. Firstly...
He can tell you're talking,
yeah,
about,
no,
him.
No, exactly. So there's that. The other thing for me... I don't know if this has been addressed recently on the pod. Andre Frank Zambo Anguissa. How is he doing? Lots of love, a Fulham fan.
He's doing brilliantly.
That's a shame.
I really like him. They have this midfield three, certainly the first choice midfield three, where you can include Fabian Ruiz and you can include Piotr Zielinski, and they're both real ball players. They're both players who are very comfortable spreading it around, great distribution. And Anguissa, as I'm sure you know, as a Fulham fan, he's a dribbler. Like, he likes to pick the ball up in those deep positions and take people on. And as a sort of three-pronged midfield, as a set of options to combine together, it really works. And it's amazing because Spalletti, who's the manager, basically confessed a few weeks ago that he had no idea who Anguissa was. So he showed up at Napoli. You know, he's like a lot of Italian managers. He's one of those managers who pretty much takes a view that I tell the directors what sort of players I want. They look after that. I'll take whoever they send me. But Anguissa showed up and he didn't know who he was. But then he watched him in training and was like, oh, yeah, I can do something with this. And he is. I think right away it's sort of a strength of this Napoli team and also a concern for them because of the Africa Cup of Nations coming up in January is you've got this spine down the middle of Koulibaly at centre-back, Anguissa in midfield, and then Osimhen up front, who's been magnificent. Osimhen is wonderful. And people are already worrying about what's going to happen when all three of those go to the Africa Cup of Nations in the new year.
I'm getting incredible deja vu, which means I think may have been on this podcast. This. But if I can't be sure, then you presumably listen I'm concentrating more than the average listener. Maybe I'm not. I don't know.
I don't remember this.
Barry, do you remember it?
But then I think we've established I don't pay a huge amount of attention.
Possible. Now, look, Napoli are joint top with Milan, who beat Bologna in like a bonkers game. This was, you know, as much as those two games weren't fun, this had a lot. It was incident-filled, wasn't it?
Oh, God, yeah. Zlatan Ibrahimovic coming back from injury that's cost him the start of the season, scoring an own goal and then scoring the last goal in a 4-2 winner. Ismaïl Benacer scored a brilliant goal from outside the box after the game was 2-2. Bologna were on 10 men. They came back from 2-0 down on 10 men, then went down to 9 men. It was a lot going on in this game. And certainly not the most impressive Milan we've seen, given, again, they were playing as a team with fewer and fewer players. But Milan have now won 8 out of 9 and drawn the other one. They're joint top with Napoli because of Napoli's draw. It's a great start for them. And in fact, in really every way, they were the big winners of this weekend because Roma and Napoli drew, Inter and Juventus drew, and then they won.
Who's Bologna's manager? He had an excellent hat on.
Sinisa Mihajlovic.
Yeah. Oh, is it? Could I pick him out of a crowd if he wasn't wearing the hat? I don't know.
He always has his flat caps on. He makes them it's a really, his thing.
Yeah. It's a sort of, it was sort of reddy pink and it had a nice, it had one of those, I really can't describe this.
You look like you're trying to do an impression of a strawberry right now, Max.
No, but it was like quite a boofy flat cap with like, different, like it wasn't a Peaky Blinders one, is what I'm saying. It sort of had like a that bit in the middle where all the bits come out.
I really like the word boofy. That's it.
That's really not described.
I think I'm picturing exactly what you mean. So your description isn't as bad as you think.
I was going to say, arguably the worst description of a hat in podcast history.
We won't be getting you to do a commentary on Ladies' Day, Royal Ascot.
Watson says, can you ask Nicky about Venezia and their storied chances of survival? I bought their kit last season. I followed the end of their Serie B campaign, but know little else about them. Just that football team in Venice seems very cool.
Yeah, and it is. And they have gone through a couple of different ownerships recently trying to capitalise on that fact of them being cool and the very funky kits. Obviously, they've changed season to season, but that move to sort of really make a design kit, like a really sort of stylized kit to make internationally appealing was, I think, something that started under the previous president, Joe Tacopina. And it's very sort of conscious of trying to tap into those international markets, which might also be why they went out and signed a couple of players from the United States this summer. I think they certainly have been. I haven't had a chance to have the same sort of conversations with the current ownership of the club as I did with Tacopina. But I know when he was there, it was very sort of deliberate idea of we need to tap into the fact that we always have tourists in our city, that these people are going to want to come and see a football game and we can sell them merchandise that says Venice on it. What do you want to buy when you come to Venice? When you could buy a T-shirt that says, I went to Venice, or you could buy a football shirt that's cool and then you can go to the game and you can buy into that, which as a business strategy, to me, makes a lot of sense. Whether or not it's anywhere near as viable in this pandemic era as it was at the time when that was all being said to me is a different question. But the team is a Serie B team that has had a few upgrades to it that's struggling. I think they are going to have a hard time staying up this season the way things have started. But they're there. They are still playing in the Stadio Pierluigi Pensa, which is this extraordinary little stadium. It's barely a stadium, if I'm being honest. It's one of those Italian stadiums, which is like a lot of metal bleachers. And then it's got the director's box, which is a shipping container wedged on top of one side. And there's absolutely...
That sounds glorious.
No, there's absolutely no space whatsoever to develop it because it's on the sort of far edge of the group of islands in the center of the lagoon. But it has just the most incredible views out across the lagoon. And on a clear day, you can see all the way to the Dolomites. And you can be there watching a football game. And you're like, where am I? This is ridiculous. So it's an amazing place to watch a football game. The idea, again, certainly was to build a replacement stadium on the mainland where you can have something more modern, more developed, more designed. All of that has been put on hold with the pandemic, and we'll see if it ever comes back. For the romantic part of me thinks it would be sad if it does, because it's great where it is, the stadium, but that stadium has its problems, including on the first weekend of the season when I tweeted something about it. I got a message from someone saying, yeah, but we only had 2 beer taps in the whole Curva, so they have problems.
I do like the idea of a football stadium where the view is so beautiful that if the game is terrible, it's okay. You can just sort of mistily look into the distance. I think that's quite an important part of most lower league football stadiums, really, should be put in. All right, that'll do for Italy. And we will do Germany in part 3. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly, Bundesliga time. Archie, we haven't really talked a lot of Bundesliga yet this season.
How dare you?
So, yeah, I do apologise. There's been some stuff happening, you know, that we had to...
Are Bayern Munich still good, Archie?
I can exclusively reveal that yes. Bayern are still very good.
They beat Hoffenheim 4-0, Lewandowski. There was a bad miss from him before he got going. He scored a brilliant goal, didn't he? And they're pretty relentless.
Yeah, even without Julian Nagelsmann on the touchline, despite the fact he's fully vaccinated, he tested positive for COVID in Lisbon last week after they thumped Benfica in the Champions League. And what happened to Hoffenheim is what's happening to pretty much everyone right now. Julian Nagelsmann has settled very quickly at Bayern. And I think that many had expected or maybe willed there to be a few more problems, given that Bayern have won the last 9 Bundesliga titles. And he's made, I'd say, only some light alterations to the team. Switching Leroy Sané over to the left-hand side has been one, and Sané has come back into form. He's working against the ball, as they say. He's working back a lot more than he has before, or more noticeably anyway. And I think that's been one of the success stories, but also the fact that he hasn't tried to change too much is really benefiting Bayern. Lewandowski continues to be outstanding, and the view here in Germany is how can the Ballon d'Or go to anyone but him right now. They've only had this one blemish so far this season, which was against Eintracht Frankfurt. That was a game, though, where Kevin Trapp had the game of his life. I think if you played that game maybe 99 more times, Bayern would win every one of them, but Trapp was in unbelievable form. I was at Leverkusen the other week when Bayern were 5-0 up were 4-0 up even. I've lost count. I think they were 5-0 up at halftime. Bayern were 5-0 up after 37 minutes, and this was this before the weekend had been build is second against first. Leverkusen can really show their title credentials, and they just got blown apart by Bayern. And like, It's a worrying predicament for German football. I think we're past that.
I was going to say, is there like an existential crisis in Germany about the dominance of Bayern, or is there just kind of sort of meek acceptance that? Because it's just trying to find a way that anyone can go the distance, isn't it? I mean, does it matter?
It's a mixture in terms of the meek acceptance. I'd say that it's difficult to compete when you don't have the same access route to investors that you do have in England, and you hear club figures in the rest of the league saying, well, at what cost would it be to sacrifice our current business model? I agree with that, in that what is the point now of Germany just opening up the floodgates? Because I don't think that it would have a noticeable effect. And the one thing that German football has going for it is the fan ownership based approach. And what that does in terms of the feeling of the fans, of feeling like they have their own club, in a actual tangible way, looking at you, Newcastle. So I think that for now, like, there have been attempts to smash the 50+1 rule, particularly by Hanover president Martin Kind in the past few years. That's not happened. It still feels like it's wobbling a bit. But yeah, like, there's a desperation for Bayern not to win the league, but not at sacrificing all costs.
Right. And how come Bayern have so much dominance with this 50+1 model? Are their 50+1 just a hell of a lot richer than the 50+1s elsewhere? Or they just have more investment in the 49%? How does it work?
I think Bayern benefit from where they are, geographically, and the kinds of companies that are down in Munich. But also, if you want to see why Bayern are so far ahead, you have to look back to Uli Hoeneß and how he developed the club on a business front, and how they just got so far ahead pretty early on and have developed a financial basis which is, yeah, remarkable. And that's the thing, is why, like, whilst Dortmund can pay out reasonable transfer sums, they don't pay anywhere near the same wages as Bayern. And I think it's the wages that make them very difficult to compete against. But yeah, Bayern have just grown into this worldwide super brand. And that's with, I think, It's a similar effect, though, in the last 10 years of the financial prize money that you get, and the TV money you get from the Champions League, that has also helped catapult them away from other clubs. And also, I'd say in the Bundesliga, the clubs who do circumvent the 50+1 rule, your Leverkusens, your Wolfsburgs, RB Leipzig, they have really decent resources, but don't make the most of them. RB Leipzig have a lot of money.
I was curious about Leipzig because they've obviously had this very particular story and rise. And I don't know if they... Is their ownership the sort that has like a stated ambition? Like, is there an ambition to eventually get ahead of Munich? Or is it less sort of direct than that?
Oliver Mintzlaff, their CEO, said before this season that they wanted Julian Nagelsmann to feel them this season. Like, their idea is that, yeah, they should be challenging at the top end of the table, but I think their playing philosophy this season, this whole idea of they've gone back to their roots with Jesse Marsh has been a bit, yeah, convoluted. It doesn't make sense, I think, with the amount of good ball players they have. This is looks like their strongest squad that they've had on paper, with some of the signings they've made. Dominic Szoboszlai came last season, for example. Andre Silva, who was one of the top scorers in the Bundesliga last season, arrived in the summer, and yet things haven't really quite clicked. But as you say, it's not like they've come out, I would say, with, you know, bold statements like we want to be the next Bayern and that.
Archie, you mentioned there Julian Nagelsmann missed the game because he had COVID, and I see Joshua Kimmich has caused a bit of a palaver by coming out and saying he hasn't been vaccinated. Mm-hmm. He hasn't ruled out getting vaccinated, but it seems to have caused a stir because he's seen as quite an enlightened, smart player.
Yeah, this is the big story in Germany right now. This broke on Friday night from the Bild newspaper, who themselves have been going through something of a crisis because Joshua Kimmich was questioned by interviewer from Sky, Patrick Vassasier, at the weekend in this interview where he said, yeah, I'm not a corona denier. I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I'm being tested 2-3 times a week. His justification of it was that you'll notice that there's breaches, that people still get it, even with people who aren't vaccinated. But the big problem with this, with Joshua Kimmich, is that he is the face and initiator of a multi-million euro initiative called We Kick Corona, which was started by him and his teammate Leon Goretzka. And I think that the biggest hypocrisy in it is that Kimmich is quoted on the website of that saying that that solidarity matters, whether in on a big scale or a small scale. And I think that's where the big conflict of interest lies, because how can you be saying it's important that, you know, we all stand together, and then just because he's privileged enough, he's not getting the vaccine? He says he has his reservations, and from teammates they say that they respect that, but at the same time, even if he says yeah, he's likely that he'll get vaccinated in the future, it's not a great look.
He's like the opposite of the Fox News presenters who have been vaccinated, yeah, who say don't get vaccinated. He's the anti Tucker Carlson. That's what he is. He's like, everybody get vaccinated, I'm not, but you know,
yeah,
that's fine. I mean, the best thing would be if he did, I guess. But you know, I wrote an article about this and I got a lot of strange messages on Instagram. So
the irony of it is that Joshua Kimmich, the footballer, can play in every Bundesliga stadium, but if he was a fan, he could not enter every Bundesliga stadium right now, because in some of them they have what they call 2G, which is you need to have either, you have proof that you've recovered from the virus or that you are vaccinated, and which compares to 3G, which is
a sand-based astroturf that could have ripped your knees up every week.
Genesen, geimpft, oder getestet. Either recovered, vaccinated, or tested. And yeah.
Okay, that is very interesting. Can we talk about Jude Bellingham? It was like Ricky Villa, I thought, in a way. it was so good, wasn't it?
Poetry in motion, as one local newspaper in Dortmund described it. The way that it just shows his swagger of beating two players, and then just the finish as well, a lovely little dink over Bielefeld goalkeeper Stefan Ortega. This is the new Jude Bellingham as well, one who is breaking into the box a little bit more. This has been a change under new coach Marco Rosa, and it's giving him even more freedom to express himself. And boy, is he doing that. And the chance of Jude from the Dortmund fans is something that is a very regular occurrence right now. He's having an amazing season, whether it's his work in midfield, the energy that he shows on a weekly basis, or whether it was when Erling Haaland scored a winner away at Leverkusen and a fan chucked a beer towards him and he caught the beer. Anything he does right now turns to gold. And I just think his whole attitude was symbolized by his celebration at the weekend, where he just stands in front of the fans, arms wide open, and it's this are you not entertained vibe. So yeah, he's really quite something for 18 to be playing the way he is. It's exciting from an England perspective, I would say, and I really wonder how much longer Borussia Dortmund can keep him if he keeps playing like this.
Mark Van Bommel's been sacked. Matt would like to hear about Freiburg, and Charlie would like to hear about Stefan Baumgart's flat cap and if it's acceptable attire for a football manager. And we've done quite a lot on managers' flat caps already.
Sure.
But can you address all those three, please?
Okay, so Mark Van Bommel has been sacked after 8 games without a win, but I think he's gone more because the style of play was significantly more regressive than it was under Oliver Glasner, who got them into the Champions League, fell out with sporting director Jörg Schmatker, which is nothing new, but also, yeah, just how defensively minded Van Bommel was with the talent at his disposal. Only Bayern spent more than them in the summer. Kicked out of the DFB Cup because they made one too many substitutions and bottom of their Champions League group. Yeah, things weren't good enough. We moved to...
Freiburg?
Freiburg, yeah, sure. They are the perennial Bundesliga underdogs, led by maverick coach Christian Streich, who is, yeah, always emotional, always with... over the years, the most entertaining press conferences for the sorts of issues that he addresses. I think the best show of what kind of an intellectual character that Christian Streich is that a few years ago, he took part in a talk on the lessons to be learned from the 1932 election, and was part of a panel alongside two historians and two political scientists. Yeah, he's really something else. A quote from him in 2017, for example: reading is existentially important for me in order to get into another space. You can't imagine Sam Allardyce saying that. For example,
Sam Allardyce did once say to me when we were discussing toasties, "I'm not a bechamel saucer." I mean, it's also a quote, isn't it?
It is. So. Like, he places a big emphasis on social responsibility amongst his players. That doesn't explain why they're absolutely killing it in the Bundesliga right now. I think that actually a good explanation for why Freiburg are doing well is very few departures in the summer, and kept load of their best players, but also their best players, they have a good core who want to stay at the club. Christian Günther, their left back, has been superb, and their captain. They have a guy called Nico Schlotterbeck at centre back, who's come back from loan on, who was on loan at Union Berlin and has been very good. You will remember something that Mark Flecken did, I think, Max, but you won't remember his name. He is their goalkeeper. Do you remember when in Germany a few years ago, a goalkeeper went to drink from his water bottle, he turned round and the ball was in his goal?
Yes.
Yes?
I think so, yes.
Okay. That goalkeeper was Mark Flecken.
Okay, good.
And he's doing very well. But yeah, like, just generally, the whole ethos of the club, like, there is this big emphasis on togetherness and the fact that the players do a lot more in their private time with each other than at other clubs, I think, in the Bundesliga. They really, like, work for each other. The scouting is incredible. The conversations that they have with players before joining, there's an emphasis on what happens if you're on the bench for 4 or 5 games. They honestly approach these things. And Streich is a real father figure to the players. He can be very hard on them, but he's very honest as well if that player is going to have to go and sit out. And Freiburg, I think, are succeeding because also you've got a lot of Bundesliga clubs in transition with new coaches, and things have stayed the same mainly there.
1 minute on Baumgart's flat cap, please, before we go to Baz's Boulangerie.
So Stefan Baumgart has probably become one of the most recognisable figures in the Bundesliga now, because of the way that he moves about on the touchline, the energy that he has. He does have a very as I've had it described to me, construction worker chic to him. And he's just this absolute ball of energy who the Cologne fans have fallen in love with. And he chose at the start of the season to don some new headwear. He was more of a baseball cap guy at Paderborn, and now he's gone to flat cap, and it's become iconic, so much so that the club shop sold out of the flat caps that he wears, and have had to order a couple of thousand more in. And yeah, he's just seen as this very down-to-earth, authentic kind of guy, and in Cologne that will do a lot for you. So yeah, Stefan Baumgart's flat cap has become an iconic symbol in the Bundesliga.
I feel like that sounds like the name of a novel, Stefan Baumgart's flat cap. Like there's a story there.
Baz, let's go to the boulangerie, and specifically actually sort of unseemly scenes generally around French stadiums in quite a few of them.
Yeah, Saint-Étienne are bottom of the league, went into their weekend game against Angers with no wins from 10 games. They had 4 points. Their manager, Claude Puel, formerly of Southampton and Leicester, he pleaded with the fans. He's under extreme pressure and pleaded with the fans before the game. We must not have an atmosphere that undermines our team. So cut to the Stade Geoffrey Guichard before the game when his players are warming up. There's big banners in the stand. Puel, club leaders, players, you are responsible for the chaos. We've had enough talk. You're making us crack. There are flares raining down on the pitch. It's like apocalyptic scenes with smoke and fire. The grass on the pitch is scorched. Both goal nets are incinerated. So they can't play a game in this. So the players are escorted back to the dressing room, police escort back to the dressing room. There's police sort of monitoring Puel to make sure no one can get at him. So kickoff was delayed by an hour. And when they finally started playing, Angers went 2-0 up, prompting further fury in the stands. But Saint-Étienne rescued a point to get their 5th point of the season after 11 games. Wahbi Khazri, formerly of Sunderland, scored a wonderful free kick to make it 2-1. And Mikel Nade scored an equaliser in the 4th minute of added time. So a bad evening for Claude Puel ended on a slightly upbeat note. And then there were scenes of disquiet at Marseille as well. Their fans have been quite naughty this season. They were playing Paris Saint-Germain, held them to a scoreless draw. Both teams had a goal disallowed. PSG had Ashraf Hakimi sent off early in the second half, so played most of the second half with 10 men. And yeah, there were flares and banners there, Marseille fans protesting. At one stage, Neymar was taking a corner and two policemen, riot policemen with shields, had to stand between him and the crowd to block and intercept all the missiles that were being rained down on him. So Marseille already have a 1-point deduction hanging over them. It was suspended, but because of this poor behaviour, it will probably be triggered now, and that decision will be made by the French League on the November the 3rd. And finally, Versailles Magistrates Court has set the date for the final verdict in the Mathieu Valbuena blackmail sex tape case, which 5 men, including Karim Benzema, are charged with complicity in that. And the prosecutor is looking for a 10-month suspended sentence for Benzema plus a €75,000 fine. And that will be sorted out on the 24th of November.
Thank you, Baz. Benzema denies all the allegations. You mentioned Claude Puel there and the apocalyptic scenes. Sort of imagine if you were in an apocalypse and you somehow survived and you look to your left of all the football managers to help you through, you know, the sort of post-apocalyptic world. I'm not sure Claude Puel's the guy.
Yeah, he was always renowned when he was at Southampton and Leicester as a bit of a charisma vacuum. He did quite well at Southampton. I think he brought them to the FA Cup final, didn't he? And didn't last too long at Leicester.
I've always thought he looks like one of the orcs from Lord of the Rings.
It's a bit harsh.
He doesn't look like that, does he? Just looks like a mild-mannered bloke who's in middle management somewhere, you know, pottering around. Maybe the apocalypse is what could bring him to life. You know, you'd find out he had all these worldly skills.
I'd not have gone in if Barry thinks what I've said is harsh. Okay.
Anyway, just a couple of tweets from yesterday's pod and today's. Jeff says, I'd like to say how much I appreciate the Europods. I used to grow up watching the Australian World Game Show in the 90s, which showcased highlights from around Europe for around 60 minutes. As a result, I always had a team in each league I'd keep an eye on. Thank you, Jeff. Not looking good. Regarding the smell of footballers, I can't remember who we were discussing. Patrick Vieira has a wonderful scent, apparently. Some wag gave the aftershave sold in the Liverpool club shop the nickname "You'll Never Walk Cologne," which is quite nice. Daniel says, we had a deep dive into bay leaves yesterday. Daniel says, I think on today's pod, an important discussion was missed, the importance of players having high self bay leaf.
Oh, thank God. You.
And James says, the bloke who says, "This is The Guardian," right at the beginning of the pod, sounds like someone who's already listened and expects far better. It's as if you've edited out him saying, "For fuck's sake," before the "This is The Guardian" bit. Anyway, thank you, James. And thanks for getting past the disappointed man who's already listened to this pod and didn't think it was any good. Right, that'll do for today. Barry, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Archie.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thanks, Max.
We'll be back on Thursday.
This is The Guardian.